Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dofino. We appreciate your waiting so patiently. And we are ready to begin. I understand both sides are ready. Okay. Then if you call the case, please, we'll get started. Roslyn?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Roslyn Tippett, here representing Richard Brumfield, the appellant. This is a sovereign immunity case. In the trial court below, the Texas Department of Transportation filed a plea to the jurisdiction as well as a no evidence motion for summary judgment challenging the trial court subject matter jurisdiction. The trial court erred in granting both of those motions because there was enough facts to raise a genuine issue of material fact on all the challenged elements of the jurisdictional claim, and furthermore, because the no evidence motion for summary judgment was the inappropriate vehicle by which to secure a ruling on a challenge to the jurisdiction. To start with, I'll just go over the factual background and then discuss some of the elements and the issues. This case began on June the 27th, 2010. Richard Brumfield was operating his motorcycle on the access road of Highway 360. At about 10 miles per hour, he entered the entrance ramp to the highway, at which time his motorcycle inexplicably crashed. It was just a single motorcycle collision, and it turns out that that area of the roadway, as it led up to the entrance ramp, had just undergone construction by the Texas Department of Transportation. Specifically, because the street had had some noticeable alligator cracking, Texas Department of Transportation went in and did some millwork and grading of the area. However, no overlay had actually been applied yet. It was still an active construction site. The issues in this case deal with, first, whether or not we consider the defect to be a special defect or an ordinary premise defect. Distinction at hand, obviously significant because it delegates the duty that Texas Department of Transportation owed, whether it be in the instance of a special defect, the duty to an invitee, or an ordinary premise defect, the duty to a licensee. In that regard, we have pled we did plead these things alternatively. First, we contend that there's evidence that substantiates that the court should have found this to be a special defect. We don't know one way or the other how the trial judge found on this issue. We simply know that the summary judgment and the plea of jurisdiction were granted. But in regard to special defect, the Texas Tort Claims Act does not define what a special defect is other than to liken it to an excavation or an obstruction on the highways, roads, or streets. Case law is sometimes categorized that as an unexpected or unusual danger to ordinary users, and then what we have in this case is, first of all, the motion for summary judgment that was filed called the defect an excavation. But semantics aside, when a witness was interviewed, Andrew Michael Granger, he was asked several times about the excavate, and he gave testimony in response to those questions that described the condition of the premises as an excavation. Now, Andrew Michael Granger, if you might recall from reading the briefs, he is the individual who also rode his motorcycle 4 days before Mr. Brumfield and had a collision, just like Mr. Brumfield, when he entered this condition. And all the evidence shows that the state of the roadway had not changed 1 ounce between the two collisions. So Mr. Granger's testimony is informative because it lets us know what the scene looked like helped us characterize what the condition presented for drivers, specifically motorcycle drivers on that day. We believe that this testimony where it was elicited from him that this was an excavation amounts to evidence that this was a special defect. But more than that, we liken this case to the case of Morris versus State, the 1995 case out of the Beaumont Court of Appeals, where the court looked at a 6-inch drop off the shoulder of the road and concluded that that presented evidence of a special defect. Now, I do want to take the opportunity to distinguish the Texas Supreme Court case of City of Dallas versus Reed, because in that case, the Texas Supreme Court did hold that a 2-inch drop off between two lanes of a highway causing a motorcyclist to wreck was not a special defect. But that case is extremely different for a very important reason. In that case, the 2-inch drop-off that they're talking about was in the middle of the road, and it was a result of natural deterioration. There was no evidence in that case of any testimony being elicited that characterized that condition to be likened to an excavation. Moreover, the Texas Supreme Court in Reed looked at what that meant as far as whether or not it was an unusually dangerous condition and said that ordinary drivers in the normal course of driving should expect these slight variations on the road caused by normal deterioration. What we have here is not a condition caused by normal deterioration that a driver would expect on the road. What we have here is a created condition, a condition specifically and intentionally created by the Texas Department of Transportation. So it's a completely different situation when we're trying to say whether or not this drop-off amounted to a special defect. So we don't find City of Dallas versus Reed persuasive in that regard. But even if this court says, I cannot get there, I can't liken this to an excavation, we believe there's still enough evidence that was elicited to create a fact question that would raise a duty on the issue of ordinary premise defect. So the standard's less, but we still had enough evidence to raise a fact question in that regard. Both special defect and ordinary premise defect have the common element that there must have been at least some knowledge on the part of the Texas Department of Transportation as to the unreasonable defect. However, this becomes a non-issue when the governmental entity actually creates the condition of what we're complained about. And that was stated in City of Houston versus Hagman by the Houston Court of Appeals in 1961. And it's even today in 2004 and 1993, these concepts were reiterated by Price Construction versus Castillo in San Antonio and Mitchell versus City of Dallas in 1993. You know, for instance, in that Mitchell case I spoke of, it was a governmental immunity case. The parents of a bicycle rider was injured in a park and brought an action against the city, alleging negligence in the construction and maintenance of a retaining wall near a creek bed and then the failure to warn of the drop-off. And according to the court, the affidavits from the city stating that they had no prior notice of a dangerous condition or accident did not conclusively negate actual knowledge. The fact that the owner or occupier created the condition that posed the unreasonable risk of harm was sufficient to support an inference of knowledge. And that's what's important here, because as this court knows, the question is not whether or not Mr. Brumfield proved conclusively that TxDOT had actual knowledge or constructive knowledge in the case of a special defect. The question is whether or not there is a genuine issue of material fact in that regard. And that is the plea of the jurisdiction standard. There is also another element that's common to both of these special defect and ordinary defect cases, and that's what if TxDOT fails to use ordinary care to either to protect motorists from the dangerous condition, and that means either to correct the situation or to warn of the situation. Now, the TxDOT's supervisor, Samuel Scott Jones, said that there were two signs on the road 4 days prior to the accident, but he had no knowledge of whether or not they were signs there on the date of Mr. Brumfield's accident. There is an affidavit from their maintenance supervisor, Mr. Nolt, who says that there were signs there, but the signs that he's talking about are simply signs that said uneven pavement or groove pavement. They're up here by the light. They're not showing you where this problem occurs. There's not a yellow line painted on that says here. Here's where you're going to have the change in elevation. It's just the sign that says groove pavement ahead. Anyone's guess where this might be? Because the truth is, and the evidence shows in the record, that according to Mr. Granger, the first motorcyclist, you could not perceive a difference when you look down. When you're driving, you could not perceive that there was going to be any change in elevation. The street was gray. The grading was gray. Even Mr. Brumfield's testimony, when he was saying that the area was lit, but it wasn't well lighted right there, but nevertheless, he could see in front of him, and even he could perceive no difference in elevation. So the fact that there are these signs that say groove pavement somewhere ahead, that doesn't enough to discharge the duty of ordinary care. It certainly leaves a fact question that remains based on some of the other evidence. And some of the other evidence is the fact that this milling work is basically a two-day project, according to Mr. Jones. They would mill it, and they could immediately overlay it. They say that typically they'll do it within 2 days, but they can actually immediately place the overlay. In this case, they milled this on June the 22nd and again on June the 23rd. Mr. Granger had his accident on June the 24th. Nothing has been done since. And then 4 days later, Mr. Brumfield, who we're here about today, has his accident. They could have overlaid this. They could have fixed this problem quicker. They just chose to leave it unattended. And in the meantime, there were no cones or anything that was basically saying going around this area at the time. They said they don't need to do that because it's not an active construction site.
Well, they had cones out during the day, did they not, and that they took away at night?
That's true, but so at the time of both of these motorcycle accidents, there's no cones at that time. That's according to the record.
Ms. Trippett, what do you have to say about the language in the state's brief? In the brief of the Texas Department of Transportation, that's on page 20. It's on page 18, where TxDOT contends it did not receive a report of Andrew Michael Granger's accident and, in fact, did not learn about it until nearly a year later.
The evidence shows that we're not sure when they learned about it. I'll admit that's true, and that's why we can't use that as evidence of their knowledge. But what I do use Mr. Granger's accident as evidence of is the evidence of the unreasonably dangerous nature of the condition, and it's also significant because it allows us to see what that condition looked like, since the evidence showed that it did not change in between the two. So we cannot use that evidence, correct, to say they had knowledge of it. But as I stated before, knowledge can be inferred from the fact that they created that condition.
Created a condition in which the testimony from Jones was that this was a project of 2 inches being cut into the pavement, and that it was a mill and overlay job as opposed to a mill and inlay job. Now, I mean, that to me is significant in the sense that Mr. Jones is saying it's not unusual to have the project worked on with a cutting of 2 inches and then to come back later and to actually overlay the project, which is what was those were the circumstances, as I understand it, in contention of both parties' pleadings of what occurred.
Yes, Your Honor, with the exception of that we're not sure exactly how deep it is. Mr. Brumfield's never conceded that it was 2 inches. It was somewhere between 2 and 12 inches, because although Mr. Nolt's affidavit said it was 2 inches, his affidavit is conclusory in that nature. Mr. Jones' affidavit more specifically says that Typically, they milled to 2 inches, but the machine could have milled up to 12 inches. And there was nobody who, Mr. Jones said, nobody would actually go in and do a measurement of that.
But there's not any evidence from Mr. Brumfield about what his contention of the depth of the cut was.
That's true. We have not come forward with specific evidence of what the depth was, but nevertheless, we believe that there's sufficient evidence to raise a fact question as to whether or not it was unreasonably dangerous, not just because it was 2 inches versus 3 inches versus 12 inches, but also just because of the fact that it was gray on gray. It was visually imperceptible. It's right in the middle of the access road, right where you're entering an entrance ramp. It's those things, and not just the mere fact that it's 2 inches or maybe a little bit more, that raise the fact question, not conclusively prove it. I'm running out of time, and I don't have time to address the issue of whether a no evidence summary judgment is appropriate, but we contend that that is not, because it improperly shifts the burden of proof to But I'm out of time, and so I'd just like to wrap up unless this court has any other questions.
Any questions? No. Any more questions?
We'd ask that this court reverse the trial court's ruling and remand for further proceedings.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You go by Lisa, Lisa Marie, what do you go by?
Lisa.
Lisa.
May it please the court. I'm going to start by just addressing a lot of what was brought up, obviously, in opposing counsel's argument. Let me start by saying the upshot of this case is, and it's just kind of bullet points of what we've already said in our briefing, we don't have a special defect in this case. 2-inch variation in road surface, not unexpected, not unusual to usual road users. There's lots of case law on this, and we'll get into that. Even if we had a special defect situation here, TxDOT discharged its duty to warn of that via the 6 signs that were posted in the area. We similarly don't have a premises defect in this case because TxDOT's testimony makes clear they had no actual knowledge of any kind of dangerous condition in the area of the road work, nor were there reports of the crashes like counsel touched upon. So first, let me try to address her points that she raised. First of all, a no evidence motion for summary judgment is not an inappropriate way to challenge jurisdiction. It's simply one of the two ways we did it. There's nothing that anyone has pointed to saying that's improper in any way. Furthermore, we then did bring a plea to the jurisdiction as well, attached a great deal of evidence, and we've put forth our evidence in that manner.
Well, I think that the doctrine of immunity is generally considered an affirmative defense. Is that not true of TxDOT, or governmental immunity, or sovereign immunity?
Right. And immunity is an affirmative defense if we're talking about immunity from liability. We have alleged all along, we're talking simply here about immunity from suit. It's not an affirmative defense. It's a slight distinction in the immunity argument, which is what we've talked about in our brief, and the Jones case addresses that as well. So TxDOT's position has been and remains, we're talking about immunity from suit here, therefore it was proper for us to go ahead and assert that in our plea to jurisdiction and our no evidence motion for summary judgment, both. With respect to the semantics, as counsel called it, about an excavation, I just want to go ahead and say quickly, you've read the record, you've seen what we're talking about here. Excavation was used quite a bit, excavate, excavates, excavated. In a page 21 of our brief in note 5, we talk about the fact that really is, if it's read in context of everywhere it's stated throughout the record, it's a term they were using to say TxDOT was out there digging around and doing something and digging something out of the ground. It was clearly not being used in the context of, we're saying excavation because it's a special defect. TxDOT obviously wouldn't make that argument, and that is not the case here. So I think when it's read in context, it really is a semantics issue. And to use the term excavation is just simply a word choice. With respect to the Ganger testimony, yes, there was a lot of testimony elicited from him with that word. I think they just kind of got stuck on it and kept moving forward with it. With respect also to Mr. Ganger's testimony, though, and him being at the scene 4 days before, he did testify that there were signs in place the afternoon of his crash. He wasn't sure if he saw any in the morning, but he did see them in the afternoon. And what's crucial about that is, as few as 4 days prior to Mr. Brumfield's accident, there were indeed signs posted. and TxDOT has testified that signs were to be in place from the beginning of that construction overlay project to the end. So that would have been roughly June 21st through, I believe, July 6th is when they finished that. With respect to the Morse case, let me distinguish that. That case involved a 6 to 8 inch depth of a drop-off where it was up to 10 to 12 inches deep at its deepest points, much different than a 2 inch excavation, as we're calling it, but let me just scratch that, much different than a two inch difference in change in road surface elevation, particularly where in our case, our 2 inch difference in road elevation was beveled to not be a 90 degree angle. There was universal patching material placed there. All of us have experienced driving on a roadway where you've got two lanes that are being repaved, you transition into the next one, and I mean, I know you've probably done it too. I eyeball it and think, I don't want to catch my tire if it's a straight 90 degree angle. We didn't have that here. It was a fairly smooth transition, and that's evidenced also by the fact the only two people that have had any problem negotiating that were these two gentlemen. Everybody else was able to negotiate that, was able to distinguish the change in surface despite the fact that the area might have all been gray or that there was no center striping in place. And in any event, there were, again, signs warning uneven pavement, grooved pavement, and no center stripe. So, I mean, everybody should have been on notice. You're coming into a construction area here, and we are giving you information so that you can navigate it successfully. And a 2-inch beveled change in elevation is simply not an unexpected or unusual condition, nor is it unreasonably dangerous.
How do we know from the record that there were no other accidents at that point?
There were none reported. That's a good question. As counsel mentioned, the accident that Mr. Ganger had was not known to TxDOT until, I think, until this lawsuit was filed. It's unclear, as she pointed out. We don't know the exact date on which they knew that TxDOT knew about that accident, but it was not 4 days before Mr. Brumfield's accident. With respect to the Reed case, I just wanted to distinguish that as well. Counsel says that Reed doesn't apply because you had normal deterioration in that case. You had no excavation in that case and no reports. Well, again, we've had no reports here. We've had no excavation here when you read it in proper context. It's simply not a special defect. And with respect to the normal deterioration that caused the Reed difference, I think that Mr. Brumfield misses the point of that case. It's not we're talking strictly about normal deterioration here. It happened to be what happened in that case. What the focus was in that case was the size of the condition in the road and whether or not it was unexpected or unusual to a normal user of the roadway and not something that a normal user could just simply adjust to. Reed is a case that is cited time and again to say that a two inch change in a road variation just simply isn't enough to put us into a dangerous condition. With respect to premise defect, the other side mentions the Hagman case. That was the case, granted it's a 1961 case, so it's a little old, but that was a case in which the city, I believe it was the city, failed to secure 15 to 20 foot dirt walls that they knew to be unsteady, and as a result, that came loose, there was a mudslide, etc. It's a completely different set of circumstances than a 2-inch road change elevation. In the Price case, that case actually determined there was no actual knowledge, despite the fact there were reports of deficiencies in inspections by the contractor. Even still, the court held, okay, let's assume this is a premise defect. The contractor still didn't have knowledge, even in the face of these inspection deficiencies. So that case doesn't really help Mr. Brumfield. With respect to the Mitchell case, the retaining wall on a creek, again, 15 to 25 feet is a far cry from 2 inches on a surface that's been warned about and that a normal roadway user should absolutely expect in their daily travels. With respect to Mr. Nolte's affidavit, the signs that were placed, just quickly to recap, there were 6 of them placed. There were 2 uneven pavement, 2 grooved pavement, and 2 no center stripe. The argument that then the roadway user was left with no idea where those were is just simply a little bit of a stretch. When you come around the corner from Post and Paddock Lane, and you're on the access road to 360 North, there's signs visible from that intersection, and they're placed along the work area. That would alert most people to the fact something is going on. They are 48-inch by 48-inch giant orange and black reflective signs placed on 4-legged aluminum 7-foot-high stanchions. They're pretty visible, and I think that would put most folks on alert that, okay, I'm coming into a construction area. There might be some road change elevation, especially in light of, you know, grooved pavement types of signage. And again, with respect to not being able to perceive a difference in the change of elevation, it's a two-lane frontage road that we're talking about. There's already a sign that says no center stripes, so you know there's two lanes there. You don't know exactly where they meet, but it certainly wouldn't be unexpected that the change would be right in the middle of the roadway, as council mentioned. Of course it'd be right in the middle because you're going from one lane to the next. There's just nothing unexpected about this. With respect to the milling not being done immediately, Justice Meyer hit it right on the head, this is a mill and overlay job. And as I've explained in our brief, that is a job that TxDOT routinely does. It's always milled to 2 inches. There is nothing conclusive in the record, is what is said by opposing counsel, but there is. There's tons of testimony from TxDOT about the fact that we always set a mill and overlay job. We set the milling machine to 2 inches. The fact that it can be 12 inches is completely irrelevant in this case because it wasn't set to that. That's just not the case. And in any event, Mr. Ganger, Mr. Brumfield's own witness, even said in his description of the area, I think it was about a half inch that this was actually change in elevation. So there's nothing to show that this was a 12-inch milling project. That's not the case at all. And TxDOT, when doing these mill and overlay jobs, because it's such a small mill depth that they carve, can absolutely come back a few days later and change that out. They do keep the signs in place that we talked about. And as Justice Gardner said, there were cones around the area during the day and other signage that was removed at the end of each workday. But so long as they were out there working on that, the cones and other signage, in addition to the other 6 signs that were already up, were there as well. So it was pretty clear what was going on out there, and it's absolutely common practice of TxDOT to do a mill and overlay project and come back days later to do it. One other note that I made about that in our brief as well is it implies that TxDOT abandoned the site for weeks on end. That's not the case. Essentially, it fell over a 4th of July holiday. And once you factor in the holiday and the work days, the longest that TxDOT was away from that site was maybe 7 days, business days, which again is perfectly acceptable in this type of work that they were doing. And I think I've covered, I wanna make sure I've covered everything that she brought up before I turned anything else. With respect to raising a fact question that it was unreasonably dangerous, there's just nothing that's been brought forward to do that. They've had an ample amount of time. There was quite a bit of discovery done. There were at least 5 depositions taken, and they've simply brought nothing forward. We're in a place now where they've just got nothing to show that this was unreasonably dangerous, that TxDOT failed to warn of it, and that TxDOT had knowledge of it. So unless you have further questions for me, I'll give some time back
to the court. Ms. McLean, I have an observation I'd like to get you to reflect on. We see in traveling about signs in which you're driving on a Texas highway in which there is a sign that says grooved pavement ahead. Usually that's not in a construction zone, but merely in a place where, for reasons of highway design, there has been grooves cut in the highway and left there permanently. Now, I'd like to be careful that you are distinguishing that kind of condition from what was on the circumstance at Highway 360 where this entrance ramp transitioned from the service road onto the main travel portion of the highway of the 360 north, in that this was a temporary condition that was in preparation for an overlay that would result in a smooth surface when the job was completed.
Okay, at the risk of becoming a design engineer, which I am not remotely qualified to do, I will try to explain, I think, what you're asking, and I think what the answer is. I suspect the reason the grooved pavement signs were placed there, in addition to uneven pavement and the stripe missing, was part of the package of we're doing work here. I suspect the grooves that were created were because it was graded and not yet coated with the overlay that would then make it a smooth surface. I understand what you're saying about there are just certain roadway areas where they have grooved pavement, and sometimes I think it's used perhaps to slow people down or whatever the reason is, I don't know. But yeah, I think that would be the distinction here, is they probably had those signs up because they left that in a graded fashion, and until they came back and placed the smoothing overlay on it, they wanted to make sure people knew a bit about what the surface would be with those grooves.
So the groove pavement sign here was merely to warn about a condition ahead where there was a project underway that was going to eventually result in a smooth surface, but it hadn't been completed yet.
That would be my suspicion. Again, not a design engineer, as you know, but I believe that's probably the case.
All right, thank you.
No question.
Okay, thanks, Lisa. Roslyn, is there a rebuttal?
As I was preparing for today's argument, I was troubled by the fact that there are cases that deal with no evidence, summary judgments, and pleaded the jurisdiction, but that how does that resolve with what Miranda says and that we shouldn't do that? And then I stumbled upon a case that I didn't cite in my brief because I didn't see it, but it was it goes through this in great detail. The name is Greentree Servicing LLC versus Woods. The citation is 388 Southwest 3rd, 785. It's a Houston First Court of Appeals case from 2012, no petition. The court in that case held that it is error for a trial court to dispose of a case with prejudice based on a challenge to subject matter jurisdiction in a no evidence summary judgment. That court explained, to begin with, allowing a challenge to subject matter jurisdiction in a no-evidence summary judgment would have the effect of depriving a trial court of jurisdiction in a case when jurisdiction had not been affirmatively disproved, in other words, where jurisdiction simply remained uncertain. That case then talked about Miranda and said, in Miranda, Texas Supreme Court expressed concern for the circumstances when the determination of subject matter jurisdiction of the court implicates the merits of a party's cause of action. And in that circumstance, the court specifically approved treating evidentiary challenges to subject matter jurisdiction like traditional motions for summary judgment.
In fact, they said it mirrors the traditional summary judgment burden.
That's true. And then when you bring in a no evidence summary judgment, you're taking away those burdens, according to the Greentree Court, by requiring the state to meet the summary judgment standard of proof. We're protecting the plaintiffs from putting on their case simply to establish jurisdiction. No evidence summary judgment, by contrast, would allow defendants an end run around the safeguards established by the Supreme Court simply by changing the designation. Then Greentree said, we acknowledge that some courts have held a challenge to the trial court subject matter jurisdiction can be brought in a no evidence summary judgment, but each of these cases, however, have treated the matter as if it were already established Texas law, which is not the case. And back through my reviewing of the case, that is indeed what those cases were doing. Finally, the Greentree case just concluded by reasserting that we hold that a court's subject matter jurisdiction cannot be challenged in a no-evidence motion for summary judgment, and that's what Mr. Brumfield asked this court to hold consistently. But nevertheless, we're here because they did also bring a proper plea to the jurisdiction with different, which mirrors the traditional summary judgment burden. And so that is why we have raised and we have explained how we have raised a fact issue on each of the challenged jurisdictional elements. As such, we'd ask that this court reverse the trial court's decision, remand for further proceedings, and that all fact issues on immunity can be resolved by the jury.
What significance do you place, if any, Ms. Trippett, in the difference being a assertion of immunity from suit not being an affirmative defense? Not being, in other words, the difference being an assertion of immunity from suit as opposed to immunity from liability?
There may be some legitimacy to that. I mean, generally speaking, obviously, the immunity is an affirmative defense, but the Texas Supreme Court has already set up that how that is treated a little bit differently than most affirmative defenses when it sets up how we plead to plead the jurisdiction. And what I mean by that is the Texas Supreme Court has already said what you do is plaintiffs pleads immunity. Defendant comes in and says, here's some evidence that shows that that pleading's not correct. And then plaintiff comes back in and then creates a fact question. Supreme Court's already set up the pattern and the formula for it. So it you're right, it might affect how the traditional immunity standard is set up.
Thank you.
Oops. Thank you. We appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business. You are our only case today, so there will be nothing to stay and watch, and this court will be adjourned.